Well, we are dealing with a series called God and Skeptics. I am dealing with part one, which deals with seven skeptical doubts. These are the doubts by skeptics that are saying Christianity especially, but even belief in God, is not warranted, and here's why. We're looking at our third of the seven skeptical doubts, and that is that Christianity is a straitjacket. I love to go to magic shows, and invariably you see very many of them. You find some guy who is trying to imitate Houdini of old and escape from a straitjacket. So I'm too old and feeble and have bad shoulders. I can't do that. I can barely escape from my coat jacket. But the thing is that a straitjacket is made to harness people that would do harm to themselves and others. And the idea that Christianity is a straitjacket, it limits you unnecessarily, is one that we'd like to deal with today. So let me begin by defining the argument and explain that actually this brings about four charges against Christianity. So I think we can see that, right?
I'm trying to find it, sorry.
Okay, should be very next slide. It's working very slowly. No, next one. That's all right, I'll let you bring that up when you can. Christianity is a straitjacket, defining the argument, four charges against Christianity. This should be the newest one that I gave you. All right, defining the argument, four charges. Here are some quotes from young people who were expressing this attitude. Christians believe that they have the absolute truth that everyone else has to believe or else, said Keith, a young artist living in Brooklyn. That attitude endangers everyone's freedom. If you catch the idea, what he's saying is that the idea that you have absolute truth, and therefore anyone who would try to believe truth must believe that, that limits or endangers everyone's freedom to choose their own truth. Yes, agreed Chloe, another young artist, a one-truth-fits-all approach is just too confining. The Christians I know don't seem to have the freedom to think for themselves. I believe each individual must determine truth for himself or herself. And these quotes are from an email survey of young New Yorkers in their mid-20s. Now, the four arguments that they give to promote this idea that Christianity is a straitjacket is, the first argument is about truth. Truth, they would say, this argument is, it is a belief in absolute truth, one that cannot be denied. Is it the enemy of freedom? Christianity names some beliefs as heresy and some practices as immoral. This leads to the charge that since Christianity holds to absolute truth, it endangers personal freedom. All right, this is the very idea that because we hold to the idea of absolute truth, a truth that is the truth, no matter what else you'd like to believe, that it endangers personal freedom. Secondly, community. The church bars from its community those who transgress its doctrinal and moral boundaries. To contemporary observers, this endangers civic freedom because it divides rather than unites our population. This leads to the charge that Christianity restricts community. So truth, community. The third is culture. It also appears to be culturally narrow. failing to recognize that various cultures have different perspectives on reality. This leads to the charge that Christianity demands all cultures to bow to its own. And then fourth is intellectual freedom. It seems to enslave or at least infantilize its members, determining what they must believe and practice in every particular. This leads to the charge that Christianity limits intellectual freedom. Well, Angie, if you can't find it, then I just gave you the wrong one. Okay. So I have to imagine this on your screen. Four things: truth, community, culture, and intellectual freedom. The first one then will deal with debating that argument. We were defining it, now we'll debate it. The four truths supporting Christianity. One, belief in truth, that they say if we believe a certain truth is the absolute truth, that we are an enemy of freedom, belief in truth is unavoidable. The fact is that all of these people who are proclaiming this think they're proclaiming the truth that we should bow to, the truth that we should believe. Charging that Christianity's claim to absolute truth endangers personal freedom presupposes a certain doctrine, the postmodernist philosophy that there is no one truth. You must believe that before you can consider that believing that something is true is a danger. For instance, the French philosopher Michel Foucault, October 15, 1926, died June 25, 1984. He writes in his article, Truth and Power, in a book collecting these things, Power, Knowledge, Selected Interviews, and Other Writings. He says this: truth is a thing of this world. In other words, it's been generated by the men of the world. It is produced only by multiple forms of constraint. So you have to believe it. Some bully is telling you, if you don't, you're going to be sorry. And that includes the regular effects of power. So he says, if you have the power, you can proclaim the truth. You catch that idea? That you can't believe what you want to believe, you must believe what I believe, or I'll beat you up. I have the power. Now, following this thought, and following his thought, many are alleging that any claim to truth is really a power play, an attempt to control others. Now, at the surface, this is just foolish. When you work out a mathematical equation and you come to the answer, it's not good enough to have an approximate answer. You come to an actual numerical digit, you see. And there is no limit to intellectual freedom by doing that. This is a foolish concept. But when you think about it, the argument fails automatically because it condemns itself. If Foucault, who said these things, claims that what he says is true, then we must point his finger back at himself, saying he must be trying to control us. And in fact, we can see it. Those of us who believe in the Christian faith can say, you're trying to control us to not believe. The attitude that you can explain everything away explains away your own explanation. C.S. Lewis put it this way in his book, The Abolition of Man. You cannot go on seeing through things forever. The whole point of seeing through something is to see something through it. It is good that the window should be transparent because the street or the garden beyond is opaque. You can see it. How if you saw through the garden too? So to see through all things is the same as not to see. You're just looking out, seeing through all things. Well, I see the stars. No, I see through the stars. So you see nothing. And explaining everything away doesn't explain. For instance, Sigmund Freud, he claimed that all truth claims about religion and God were psychological projections to deal with guilt and insecurity. Taking him at his word, if he were correct in making this truth claim about religion and God, belief in God, we must assume it was to cover his own guilt and his own insecurity. So we have seen through his argument, and we don't have to believe it. It works against itself. Here's the thing. If an atheist tries to work against oppression of others, and many do, then he must assume that there is some kind of truth that applies to everybody. He wants them to change their minds about their attitude of oppression. Maybe they've grown up in a civilization where oppressing a certain kind of people is normal. It's the normal way to think. The atheist here is saying, stop thinking like that, change and think like I think, that you should not oppress people. Now, the Christian would agree with that philosophy, but the Christian has a reason, and the atheist doesn't. He wants to change others to his point of view, therefore he has a claim that this is true beyond himself. G.K. Chesterton, in his book Orthodoxy, The Romance of Faith, revealed this. For all denunciation, in other words, when you denounce something, implies a moral doctrine of some kind. When you say that ought not to be done, you're holding that activity up against a standard of moral doctrine. He says, just to say that you rebel against everything doesn't work. He said, by rebelling against everything, he has lost his right to rebel against anything. If nothing is true, then you are not true, and you have no right to rebel against anything. Because everybody has the same right as you, evidently. The second argument deals with community. And this is a false argument from the beginning. Community cannot be completely inclusive. To say that by taking a stand on what we believe is right and wrong limits community is a false concept. For every community that is chosen cannot be completely inclusive. It doesn't make any sense. The charge that Christianity restricts community fails because no community, whether religious or secular, can exist without some kind of restriction. That's inherent in the concept. It is a foolish argument to insist that human communities should be completely inclusive. Everybody's welcome, see? Open to all based on our common humanity. It's an oversimplification to the extreme. Now, for instance, our church is open for anybody to come. It is not open for everyone to be a member, and it is not open for every member to be on the board of deacons. There are restrictions. There are belief restrictions. But this is inherent in the concept. All communities are based on certain presuppositions. All communities. For instance, the most liberal democracy gives a preference to individual rights over community rights. It divides private from public morality. It makes personal choice a most holy thing. These assumptions are foreign to many other cultures, many of the Asian cultures. Community is all about how you must be down and the people around you must be up. We may argue that Western society bases its community on a shared commitment to reason, to rights, and to justice. But we have to admit that not everybody defines even these ideas in the same way. A community perceives rights and justice in the context of a particular set of beliefs about the meaning of human life. Rights is talking about the meaning of human life. So you have to define that. Since every person, especially those from diverse backgrounds, must have a different set of beliefs, no community can exist that includes everyone equally. Well, let's take an imaginary example, a mind experiment. Imagine two associations with very different purposes. So someone on this side of town on the board of the Gay and Lesbian Rights Task Force, somebody on the board there, comes to the board meeting and he announces, "I have had a religious awakening. I now believe homosexuality to be a sin." Then across the city, there's the board of the Alliance Against Same-Sex Marriage. They meet, and a member of the board announces, "I discovered that my son is gay. I now believe that he has the right to marry his partner." All right, well, there's a situation. Now, even though most, I think, would consider that the gay rights group is very inclusive, and the other has a reputation for being exclusive, both of them must eventually exclude the board member who rejects the group's basic values. You see that? The idea is that you have certain standards for communities. So the only group that could be totally inclusive would be the Everybody Club. It would have no corporate identity. It would never hold its members accountable to specific beliefs and practices. So what's the point, see? Why is this a group? All right, what am I saying then? I'm saying that there is a better way to determine if a community is open and caring or narrow and oppressive. Ask two questions. One, ask which community has beliefs that lead its members to treat persons in other communities with love and respect. Ask, secondly, which community's beliefs lead it to demonize and attack those who violate its boundaries. So if a Christian group, a group that claims to be Christian, condemns unbelievers and treats them in an ungracious way, we would recognize that's not the Christian standard. They've adopted a different standard. The Bible holds Christians to the standard of how God dealt with us as sinners. Simply maintaining standards in accordance with Christian beliefs, that should not be criticized, because every community holds to its own standards. So it's a false argument. The third was dealing with culture, that Christianity is culturally rigid. This is just untrue. Christianity is not culturally rigid. I remember reading that there was perhaps a time when England first sent out missionaries, that they were about as interested in spreading English culture, tea time, crumpets, you know, as they were in spreading the Christianity. That time is no more. England is receiving missionaries, not sending out missionaries for the most part. In fact, here's the truth. Christianity has been more adaptive and less destructive to diverse cultures than other religions and even secularism itself. More adaptive, less destructive. They point to the idea that Christians would, in various countries, would have certain shrines torn down. Well, it wasn't that there was a fear of the shrine. It was that when it was no longer in use and the people didn't need it anymore, then it became an offense to the community, and they tore it down. But Christianity has been more adaptive and less destructive than other cultures and even secularism itself. Consider the beginning of Christianity. It began in Palestine with Jews, and so it had a very Jewish culture. Then, because of Paul and his missionary team, it moved mainly over into Europe, and the Hellenistic people, the people influenced by the Greek and Roman cultures, they became Christians, and those people centered around the Mediterranean. That was how the church adapted. It became a non-Jewish church to those people. Then later, it moved over to Western Europe and North America. And so we look around and we say, well, these are the way churches are run here in North America. Today, however, and you might be unfamiliar with this statistic, but today, most Christians in the world live in Africa, Latin America, and Asia. Lamansana, in his book, Whose Religion is Christianity, revealed that in 1900, the year 1900, 9% of Africans were Christians, and four times that were Muslim. In the 1960s, 60 years later, Christianity passed Islam in number. Now, I admit we're talking about all those who would call themselves Christian, not everybody who's a fundamental Baptist like me. And today in Africa, Christians comprise 44% of the population. This explosive growth is now being seen, granted covertly, in China. Some estimate that in 30 years, perhaps 30% of the 1.5 billion Chinese will be Christians. We have found that there have been certain city-states within China that have welcomed Christian teachers and welcomed them to teach English to their students by teaching them the Bible. And they felt honored to do so. So it's still a communist country, and you still can't go in as a missionary and all that type of thing. I understand that. I'm not saying that they've been converted. I'm just saying it's a growing thing. Understand this, that as Christianity enters a culture, it does make some demands, but these are demands of righteousness versus sin, but allows the church to develop naturally. I have a student at the college where I teach who is from Burma, which they don't call it there that anymore, but Myanmar, something like that. He says Burma, so I say Burma. And he was a pastor of the church there and pastor of a church here, a Burmese church here. Their services are not like ours. In Burma, their meeting places were not like ours. And in fact, he said it was like carports here. It had a roof, no walls, and you'd gather the seating things that you could under that to protect from the weather. Well, what's the church? The church is that they have become saved Christians, and that in fact they sing songs of faith, they baptize, therefore it's a church. And the cultural distinctions are irrelevant. African churches, Philippine churches, American churches are all very different, but they maintain the same core beliefs. Historian Andrew Walls says this: cultural diversity was built into the Christian faith. in Acts 15, which declared that the new Gentile Christians didn't have to enter Jewish culture. The converts had to work out a Hellenistic way of being a Christian. So, no one owns the Christian faith. There is no Christian culture the way there is an Islamic culture, which you could instantly recognize whether it's in Pakistan or Tunisia or Morocco. Even when Jesus sets up God's ideal earthly kingdom during the millennium, the people of the earth will retain their cultural differences during that time. Isaiah 60, Revelation 21 and 22 talk about these things. Let me give you an example, Revelation 21, 24. It says, "And the nations of them which are saved shall walk in the light of it, and the kings of the earth," so the nations have kings or rulers, "they do bring their glory and honor into it." These Christian nations are separate, have their own culture enough to be called a nation separate from another nation. And their kings bring their glory, their honor to the King of Kings there in Jerusalem. All right, the fourth and last argument is about freedom. And this takes some time to think it through, but freedom is not simply a lack of constraint. That's not entirely what freedom is. Early 20th century social activist Emma Goldman called Christianity the leveler of the human race, the breaker of man's will to dare and to do, an iron net, a straitjacket, which does not let him expand or grow. You can't expand or grow if you're a Christian. This is her book, The Failure of Christianity. Kind of gives away the purpose of it, huh? More recently, that was in 1913. More recently, at the end of the movie I, Robot, 2004, the robot named Sonny has fulfilled the objectives in his design program. And in these stories, somehow knowing enough makes them personally alive. So he's fulfilled his program, but here he is still alive, still working. He now realizes he no longer has a purpose. He's accomplished his purpose. The movie concludes with a dialogue between Sonny, the robot, and the other main character, Detective Spooner. Sonny says, "Now that I've fulfilled my purpose, I don't know what to do." Detective Spooner says, "I guess you'll have to find your way like the rest of us, Sonny. That's what it means to be free. You have no standard, you have no truth, you have no purpose. So just find your own way." He says, that's what it means to be free. The Supreme Court seems to have enshrined this view when it opined that the heart of liberty is, quote, "to define one's own concept of existence, to find one's own meaning of the universe." Stephen Jay Gould, a writer of science things, he says, "We're here, we humans are here, because one odd group of fishes had a particular fin anatomy that could transform into legs for terrestrial creatures. Because comets struck the Earth and wiped out dinosaurs," here I thought it was an asteroid, "thereby giving mammals a chance not otherwise available, we may yearn," he says, looking at us sorrowfully, "for a higher answer, but none exists." Get over it. This explanation, though superficially troubling, if not terrifying, is ultimately liberating and exhilarating. Facing the world without purpose, without design, having no reason to exist, he says that's liberating and exhilarating. I haven't found that to be so with most people. We cannot read the meaning of life passively in the facts of nature. We must construct these answers for ourselves. And he wrote that in, his works are included in Life, the Meaning of Life, Reflections in Words, Pictures of Why We Are Here. So in this view, freedom means there is no overall purpose for which we were created. Because if there was an overall purpose, we would be obligated to fulfill our purpose, to conform to it, to fulfill that purpose. And that would be limiting. You see? It would limit us to fulfill the purpose for which we were created. Now, this philosophy preaches that true freedom is freedom to create your own meaning and your own purpose. That sounds far more liberating than it is. Because all about us, we are limited. We are limited by gravity, by breathing. We are limited in what we can see and hear and touch and feel, and all our senses are limited. We are limited by gravity. We are limited by all these things. But the charge that Christianity limits intellectual freedom fails because it does not admit that freedom cannot be defined in strictly negative form. You can't just say, I have nothing interfering with me, therefore I'm free. Let me give you some examples of this. To my right and left are keyboard instruments. A grand piano, mini grand, something like that, baby grand, and an electronic keyboard. Now, granted, I can sit there and I have complete freedom to play it. It just sounds horrible because I don't know how to play. So when a person learns to play a musical instrument, he is not free to play beautifully until he has given himself many hours of restriction to practice. I haven't done that. A sports person is not free to play well without many hours of training. Look to these Olympic sports people. Look at their childhood, up in the dark hours going to practice before school and coming back after school. Another part of freedom includes what is natural to the person. Some little man cannot become a professional NFL lineman, no matter how long he trains. Every time he gets out there, he's going to get run over. See? Let's imagine the fish who desires freedom to be on the land. Sorry. You're not built for that, see? In fact, if you think about it, he will find true freedom only within the restriction of his water world. So it is with man. Freedom is not so much the absence of restrictions as it is the finding of the right restrictions. A friend of ours working with Child Evangelism Fellowship told us a long time ago of a situation where the parents got upset that there was a fence around the grade school playground. They said, we don't want our children to think that they're bounded. So they got together, they tore it down. The kids went out to play and they all huddled together in one area. They said, why aren't you out playing? He says, we're afraid of what's out there. See? They built the fence to protect the children and they could go play, clear up to the fence. It is not the absence of restrictions, but finding the right restrictions. Restrictions that fit our nature and our world can produce the greatest freedom. We believe God gave Christianity to man Therefore, we know that God knows all of reality. He created what we call reality. And God knows us better than we know ourselves because he created us. So he knows all of the limitations. And he knows that if we go beyond certain limits by our choices, if we pursue our appetites beyond a certain degree, it will be bad for us. We will be less free. We will be more bound to wrong habits. So when he sets restrictions of life before us, he is setting us free from slavery to these things. Our freedom is not the ability to do whatever we want. It is the freedom to be able to do what we should. This is the rewarding freedom that brings true joy. Now, when a skeptic says, every person has the right to define right and wrong for himself, then the believer's question to him should be, let me ask you, is there anyone in the world right now doing things that you believe they should stop doing, no matter what they personally believe, about the correctness of their behavior? A missionary couple came to Open Door and told us about caring for children who some war leader had come through and with his machete had whacked off the arms just at the elbow of some of the children. And this was to terrorize the people. They dare not go against them. And so I might ask this person, do you think that that warlord should stop doing that? No matter how he thinks that's a good idea to build his power. And if he says, yes, I think he should stop that, well, then I would have to pursue and say, doesn't that mean, when you think about it, that you do believe there is some kind of moral reality that is not simply defined by us? A moral reality that must be abided by regardless of what a person feels or thinks. You see, true freedom would be a freedom from having your arms lopped off. So, conclusion, let me end by saying, Christianity is summarized by love. Love, while extremely liberating, includes voluntary self-restrictions. Love is the most liberating freedom of all, yet it involves a certain amount of loss. Since Christian love is concerned with meeting the needs of the loved one, even if it demands personal sacrifice, then true love, Christian love, demands the loss of some independence. To gain the freedom of love, you must limit your freedom in several ways. For instance, a loving husband, no longer makes decisions about his evenings without considering the needs and wishes of his wife. To experience the freedom of love, you must give up some of your personal autonomy, your own personal self-rule. A loving couple will experience a mutual loss of independence. At first sight, the believer's relationship with God seems to be one where the believer does all the adjusting, while the perfect God does not adjust for the believer at all. This is not the real situation. And at Easter time, it's a great time to remember, in the most radical way, God has adjusted to us. God reached into humanity with his Son, Jesus, and he became flesh. On the cross, Jesus submitted to our condition and died in our place as a payment for our sin. God, through Christ, said, I will adjust to you. I will change for you. I'll serve your needs, even though it demands a terrible sacrifice from me. So, Christianity is not a straitjacket. It is a release from the straitjacket of personal sin and the dominance of sin over us. It is the final liberation that takes us away from the domination of the devil's rule and puts us in the freedom of the light of truth, the light of understanding the way things really are, the light of God's forgiveness. Let's pray. Our Father, how we thank you for this time that we can look at this concept of doubt and realize that it is entrenched within a false philosophy in and of itself. These self-philosophies condemn themselves and don't work in the real world. We ask that you might open then the skeptic's eyes to doubt his doubts and to explore this area of the Christian faith. We pray thy blessing in Jesus' name. Amen. Thank you.